I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 21st of January. This hour, we talk about the chemical spill in West Virginia on January 9, which left more than 300,000 people without usable water. 7,500 gallons of a chemical that's used to clean coal leaked from a storage tank in the Elk River. And many, although the ban has been lifted, pregnant women are still advised not to drink the water. And there are many who say the water still has a funny color and it still smells bad. So wouldn't you think maybe it's not a good idea to drink the water? We have two guests with us to talk about all of the many issues associated with this. West Virginia's strong ties to coal and chemicals and an opposition to environmental regulation. And the other states that are coal mining states in this country. And what risks are posed to other populations. Do states regulate these kinds of chemicals? Does anybody regulate these kinds of chemicals? How often are they inspected? We're going to be talking about all of that this hour of our program. And we have two guests with us joining the conversation, and they're both joining us from West Virginia. Jeff Biggers is an award-winning author. His stories have appeared on National Public Radio, Public Radio International, The New York Times, Washington Post, The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, and Salon. He is the author of quite a few books, The United States of Appalachia, How Southern Mountaineers Brought Independence, Culture, and Enlightenment to America. Jeff, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Also joining us is Bob Kincaid. Bob is co-founder of the Appalachian Community's Health Emergency Campaign and president of Coal River Mountain Watch. Also participated in keeping mountaintop removal out of northern Wisconsin's Pinocchio Hills. He lives in Fayette County, West Virginia, where his ancestors settled in the mid-18th century. Bob, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Kathleen.
Thank you both. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can always find us on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Jeff, let's start with you. Give us the latest news update. Is anybody drinking the water now?
I saw that the Senator Joe Manchin was willing to take a drink. We're not sure what happened to him afterwards. But I think the truth is you still have a large part of these several counties, it's up to nine counties, who are affected by the water contamination, who still don't know what to do. We have a tremendous amount of confusion still about whether or not the flush out, as they're referring to it, is actually functional and will not have a fallout or an after effect. And so I think right now you have a sort of a state of confusion of people. Of whether or not they truly can rely on their public officials and their determination. I think that's a big issue right now. It comes down to public trust.
And what does the water smell like and taste like right now? Is it getting a little better, or what were people experiencing, Bob?
Reports that I'm seeing, Kathleen, indicate that there are still problems with the water, that there are still smells, that there are still discolorations. We need to understand that where Jeff mentioned the political leaders in this state. Well, as of yesterday, Governor Earl Ray Tomlin of West Virginia essentially threw 300,000 people under the bus. He said, "It's your decision whether you drink the water or not. I'm not a scientist."
That's what he said?
Yes, really. I'm not kidding.
Does he drink the water?
He said in response to that exact question, he said, "I drink it occasionally," or maybe it was "from time to time."
Tell me about what this chemical is and why it's something that wasn't investigated pretty thoroughly. My understanding is that they went to this plant every now and then, but nobody really looked at the storage tanks, and nobody seemed to know very much about MCHM.
These storage tanks actually started life as a Pennzoil installation for, I believe, diesel fuel.
Really?
Yes. But they got rid of it. They sold it off, and this outfit came in to because you can make a lot of money doing things for the coal industry in West Virginia and Central Appalachia generally. And so they were going to provide the chemicals to the coal industry that would then be used in the processing of coal so that it could be transshipped or burned in power plants, what have you. And that's what this chemical is.
Mm-hmm.
It is a it is a chemical used in the processing plants, and when they're done with it, they pump it up behind giant seas of toxic waste that exist all over southern West Virginia, or else they pump it back into the ground. So what we have here, Kathleen, is actually a portion. This what's going on right now is a portion of a longer experiment. Right now, there's an experiment going on to find out what the toxic effects are of methyl cyclohexane methanol on 300,000 people. But that experiment, that's just one part of it. That experiment has also been going on in West Virginia's mountaintop removal communities for way over a decade.
Hmm. There was a piece in National Geographic, Jeff, let's go to you on this, on water filtration, saying that the West Virginia American Water said they had not been testing for this chemical before the spill because it is rare and because they can't afford to test for every single chemical. What's your response to that?
You know, I think it's a very important issue on this testing. Once again, as Bob points out, that site itself had not been visited since 1991, which is almost 23 years ago. I think what we have is this chemical is actually used in all coal slurry cleaning processes. And we mine coal not just in West Virginia, of course, but in over 20 states. So this chemical more than likely is being used in more than 20 states. And you would think by now there would be some sort of list of certain chemicals that have been tested by the federal level, by the EPA,
yes,
by the CDC and whatnot. And still there's this kind of confusion, and I'm someone who's covered this industry for over a decade, of what really is allowed, not allowed. And there's almost sort of a complete lack of the precautionary rule that something should be tested before it's actually used. I think often there's sort of a green light given to a certain chemical, and then we sort of wait until a crisis is truly a crisis and it's validated by a disaster to do a final follow-up to see if, in fact, it has some sort of toxic fallout. And I think that's exactly the situation we're dealing with here. This is once again, a chemical we've been using for many, many years, and it's only now that it's coming to light and to the public about its possible dangers.
What are the connections? And from reading about this, they are pretty substantial, Bob, between politicians, particularly someone like Senator Manchin, and the coal companies or chemical companies. There would appear to be perhaps an indication that Manchin has been making a lot of money because of his connection to his coal company, and thus doesn't want to overly regulate the issue and is now in a position where he can vote on whether or not there need to be more regulations.
If I may speak bluntly, Kathleen, whether it's Joe Manchin or Governor Earl Ray Tomlin or Representative Shelley Moore Capito or Representative David McKinley or Representative Nick Joe Rahal, these are all individuals who are wholly owned subsidiaries of the coal industry. And they will not do anything to upset the apple cart for that industry, which is rather bizarre, really, when you consider the declining impact of coal in a state like West Virginia. Now, this state was once very deeply involved in coal. We're producing more coal than we ever have before, but with many fewer workers. There are more workers at Walmart in West Virginia than there are working on mountaintop removal sites. But that doesn't seem to prevent them from, because there's a great deal of money involved, it doesn't prevent them from being absolutely and utterly obsequious toward the coal industry. So consequently, just to give you an example, for instance, over the last few years, a number of studies have come out indicating the profound risks to human populations who have to live near a mountaintop removal site. Now, the National Mining Association responded to one of them by saying that the birth defect study was invalid because Appalachian people are prone to incest.
Oh, my goodness. Are you serious?
Yes. When asked about the cancer and heart disease study, Governor Tomlin responded by saying, well, every day somebody says something else makes you sick. As this disaster was unfolding, this current crisis, the West Virginia Coal Association tweeted, if it's good enough to wash me, or if it's good enough to wash coal, it's good enough to wash me.
Well,
so I hope that provides a little bit of the overall context. And that's why, for instance, when this first developed, the first thing that Joe Manchin and Earl Ray Tomlin did was to run out and say, this has absolutely nothing to do with coal, which is like when parents come home and the child runs up and says, and they say, hi, how was your day? And the child says, I definitely did not shoot out the picture window with my BB gun.
Right, right. I get you. Jeff, the response, though, from people, we've seen them on television, perhaps not as much as we should have, but it did make national news for many days in a row, and there were so many people who were concerned about this. It's got to have made many people worried about their health and made many people worry about it, whether or not this water is safe. Doesn't that have some kind of political effect?
You would like to think it would, and I wrote a piece myself for Al Jazeera saying, you know, finally we have this wake-up call that we need federal intervention. You've had state organizations, citizens groups, environmental groups, just local coal mining communities who've been begging for years for some sort of federal intervention, because when you have compliance and regulation and enforcement in the hands of these state officials who are, for the most part, as Bob has really pointed out quite poignantly, in the hands of big coal, it's very hard for them to have any confidence whatsoever that there is going to be enforcement of this law. So we're hoping sort of that these kind of situations, these kind of disasters, will lead to some sort of federal intervention. On the other hand, it took the EPA an entire week even to respond to this crisis publicly. And then today, in fact, the Society of Environmental Journalists, which reached a lot of people, wrote a very stinging letter to the EPA and the CDC saying, you know, we need more public information. We need more response. We need officials who are going to be accessible to respond and actually give us information and data to do our jobs as journalists. I think what concerns me, and I'm speaking not only as a journalist and a historian, but as someone who comes, like Bob, from a coal mining community and coal mining family. My grandfather suffered with black lung disease. We're largely dealing with a tremendous case of denial when it comes to the coal industry. You know, we've known about black lung disease since 1831, but still today, three people die daily from black lung disease, 1,000 people every year from a disease that's completely preventable. You know, this is the inhalation of coal dust by our coal miners. You know, and we've known about coal slurry disasters for years. We've known about all these issues, and it's only after disaster that we get a little bit of national media attention, and then basically people walk away and don't follow up. And I think we saw that a few years ago after the Upper Big Branch coal mining disaster, when the nation truly was in mourning after we lost so many coal miners in a ridiculous methane gas explosion. But once again, even from that, we've failed to follow through with workplace safety rules for our coal miners. So I don't know. Is the nation going to wake up? Everybody's saying we need a wake-up call. But I think for the coal mining communities in West Virginia and across the country, and I think particularly for people like in Wisconsin now who are facing this incredible frac sand mining rush, this is truly a wake-up call that we have to become involved in this whole process of both enforcement and compliance and making sure that we can trust our public officials.
Before we go to phone calls, let me ask about regulations, because I'm having a hard time understanding. Obviously, somebody dropped the ball. Lots of people dropped the ball here. But who has ultimate responsibility for environmental protection in West Virginia? I have read that the regulations in your state are not enforceable unless they're approved by the legislature, so that lobbyists can lobby their lawmakers to get a revision in those laws. There was a report about a regulation requiring natural gas drillers to disclose the chemicals injected into the ground during hydraulic fracturing, and it was revised at the request of Halliburton. So does the federal government then have a higher level you can go to? Are they supposed to be helping devise regulations, or what's going on?
I'll go ahead and answer that, Bob, since you're in West Virginia.
The problem with the regulatory scheme is that it never actually provides any true relief. The Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act of 1977 was supposed to provide relief to tormented communities that had massive strip mines above them, and instead we got strip mining on steroids, as my dear friend Judy Bonds used to say, in the form of mountaintop removal. the EPA has been tepid at best in its response to mountaintop removal and other perceived hazards and real actual hazards. The only place on Earth where, I believe, the only place on Earth where methyl isocyanate was still made after the Bhopal disaster was just a few scant miles from Charleston, West Virginia. There was a fire there about 5 years ago, killed a few people, and came close to Bhopaling Charleston, the Kanawha Valley of West Virginia. And yet at the same time, the legislature and the governor and the rest of the political class, for the most part, in West Virginia, respond that regulations kill jobs. Well, the absence of regulations kill people, Kathleen. Mm. And what we ultimately need is a law, straight up, not something created in the administrative process, but a straight up law that says it is not okay to continue doing this to human beings.
We welcome phone calls. Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guests are Bob Kincaid, co-founder of the Appalachian Community's Health Emergency Campaign, president of Coal River Mountain Watch. He lives in Fayette County, West Virginia. His ancestors settled in the mid-18th century, comes from a coal mining family, as does Jeff Biggers, also our guest, an award-winning author who's done all kinds of stories on NPR and Public Radio International, New York Times. He is the author of a number of books, including The United States of Appalachia, How Southern Mountaineers Brought Independence, Culture, and Enlightenment to America. Phone lines are open for you. We will go to your calls momentarily. We are talking this hour, in case you're tuning us in, about the horrors that people in West Virginia have been experiencing as a result of that chemical spill and why there has been so little done to prevent those events from happening and what the amazing response has been from the junior senator from that state and also from the governor, and the response from the people who have been affected by this. Left more than 300,000 people without usable water and hundreds of people going to hospitals with gastrointestinal upset and burns on their body. And so how is it to be prevented, and what is the collusion between office holders and chemical and coal companies? To you in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Bob and Jeff, and start with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I wanted to make two serious points and then one tongue-in-cheek way to deal with the problem. First off, if you don't present, you don't sell. So it's important that we keep knocking on people's doors and talking to them about this issue. And secondly, I remember in 2008 I was helping with the Obama campaign with some young people, and they had stars in their eyes. And one time Obama talked about clean coal. I thought, oh, here we go again. And it just reminds me of the fact that we need to nominate the most progressive people we can in the primary elections, or we're going to be stuck with the same old stuff. And finally, I'd like to say that if you wanted to try to reach somebody and shock them a little bit, you might say, suppose that from some section of China or Russia, there was some commie al-Qaeda group of people who wanted to harm the United States. What could they do? Well, they could buy a mining company in America, try to make a lot of profits, destroy the land, and poison the water. And that would really be a way to hurt the United States. But, whoa, wait a minute. That's already happening with American companies.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Jeff, you want to start? Response?
I think Jim's points are all right on. I think Jim points out two very important things. One is this idea that somehow we can have clean extraction and clean coal. It was very disappointing to me, and I reported on it for the Huffington Post, that during the days of the disaster there in West Virginia on January 15th, in fact, the Obama administration gave $1 billion of our federal taxpayers as a gift to FutureGen, which is a clean coal experimentation plant in Illinois, your neighboring Illinois. And it was a little bit of a wake-up call to a lot of people that the president, for all of his rhetoric about climate change, continues to have this all-of-above agenda, that he continues to see the coal reserves and natural gas reserves and other fossil fuels as a great boon for the economy, and he continues to put money toward that. And I think that's something we really need to have a little bit of a reckoning with, is not only the tremendous use of federal subsidies and state subsidies to keep the coal industry alive and other fossil fuel industries alive, but how we're actually continuing this coal rush without regulatory action. I think the second thing that Jim says is very important, is that 62% of your electricity in Wisconsin, you know, 62% of your listeners are listening to your radio program because of coal fire electricity. You know, and so really Wisconsin is not that far away from West Virginia if you look at it in the big sense. We often say we all live in the coal fields, we all live in West Virginia, because we're all, for the most part, still relying on this very dirty fossil fuel. We're all relying on coal. And so I think we do need to take action.
Are there any clean energy organizations, companies springing up in West Virginia, Jeff?
Well, there's a tiny amount. You know, you have little pilot projects that are happening. I did a piece for Al Jazeera right before Christmas saying Appalachia needs regeneration, not more Christmas charity. And the truth, though, is that green jobs per capita compared to the rest of the nation are minuscule in the coal fields, be it southern West Virginia or even southern Illinois or even other areas, that the majority of these green jobs in the wind and solar industry, for example, or energy efficiency, are going elsewhere, like to our neighbors in Iowa, which are producing a tremendous amount, 25 to 30% now of electricity coming from wind power. So that's what we really need, are massive investments. There's a huge discussion afloat, and it just doesn't seem to sort of take hold, is that we need transition funds for these coal mining communities who really have paid the ultimate price for 150 years of coal mining to help them transition to clean energy manufacturing. You know, they may not be able to put up the wind turbines, but why can't they produce them? They may not be able to put up the solar panels, but why can't they build them? Why can't we sort of have a transition fund for coal miners to shift from these jobs and to work on energy efficiency or a restoration project?
And you also have to ask why we've been asking that question about clean energy, and why haven't we moved in that direction? We've been talking about it since, you know, particularly Jimmy Carter's administration and long gas lines. That's a long time.
Exactly. And so once again, your listeners really need to imagine $1 billion of their tax dollars was given to big coal companies last week by the Obama administration. And just think of where that $1 billion could have gone toward a just transition program for retraining people into clean energy manufacturing, energy efficiency, and all sorts of amazing green job proposals. I think that's really the issue we need to grapple with, is how are we going to invest in a proper transition to get off this dirty energy?
Bob, let's go to you on these. These are Facebook comments. I'll read two of them. Amy on Facebook, what's so frightening is how easily one of these accidents could permanently deprive the populace of quality necessities, water, air, and land, and once it's gone, it's gone. Linda on Facebook mentions Eric Wagner's essay last week in Huffington Post. A powerful piece conveys a lot of anger, a lot of feeling about what's happened. We have swung the pendulum, she writes, too far, and it's time we get rid of some of those politicians who promote destruction of our environment to profit a few.
Let's understand. And yeah, I read Mr. Wagner's, Professor Wagner's essay as well, and it is profoundly moving, and there's a lot of righteous anger there that he expresses very, very powerfully. And I think it needs to be understood in a larger context, sort of what Jeff was alluding to, by way of understanding that everybody's downstream. For instance, what Jim mentioned about overseas or foreign investment, please remember, tons and tons and tons of Appalachian coal gets on a boat every day and goes to China. Those clouds are now blowing back across the Pacific Ocean to the west coast of the United States. Tons of coal goes to Russia. Russian companies have actually bought coal complexes to mine out and blast away. An Indian consortium has done the same here in my county. And what's more, in a sort of spiral of this whole process, a coal baron from West Virginia has plans to destroy the entire ecosystem of northern Wisconsin in the Pinoki Hills. Okay? It's It's coming. It is coming to you. It is coming to all of us unless we band together and understand that the problems are not local or regional, but that they are national and global in scope.
Marcia in Menominee, our next caller. Hi, Marcia.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much. Wow, this is a fantastic show. I got a degree in political science at the University of Wisconsin, and I wish I could just use this show as a lesson in politics. And your guests are fantastic. What an eye-opener. I grew up in that area many, many years ago, lived in Wisconsin now all my adult life, but I can testify to the damage done to the environment, and I can agree with everything your guests are describing from a firsthand basis. And it seems that the real people that are affected are not these politicians, it's the working people, the coal miners, their families, and it's devastating. And if America knew, if the bulk of Americans knew what kind of greed is devastating that our own countrymen, our own people, where is the patriotism? It's crazy. I want you and your guests and all of the audience to go online and listen to the Darryl Webb Band sing the song Goodbye to the Sun. Country music artists, they really, they say it right. And Darryl has a line in his song, they never laid the blame for disaster when it came on the greed that posed with progress as its guide. It's greed. It's simple greed. And they talk about jobs. What kind of a job is that? Do you know anyone that aspires to grow up to be a coal miner?
Thank you, Marcia, for the call. Is it greed, Jeff?
You know, I think what it is we've allowed certain industries to continue recklessly without holding them accountable. And I think a lot of people within West Virginia, but also in other extraction communities, really talk about not so much greed, but just an outlaw mentality that these companies are allowed to have violations, to break the laws in order to increase their profits. And, of course, we saw that with the Upper Big Branch coal disaster, where here was a company that had been called out for hundreds of violations, but still was allowed to double its coal production during that same period. I think probably what we'll see more and more are revelations about how a certain amount of chemical companies and coal companies continue to violate the laws that are on the books, like the Clean Water Act, but are just essentially slapped on the wrist with penalties, and they're able to continue and make tremendous amount of profits. And once again, I think your listeners in Wisconsin really need to take this kind of issue very seriously. 75% of the frac sand mining industry is in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is pretty much the West Virginia of frac sand mining. And according to the League of Conservation Voters, there really are no drinking water standards on the books now to control for certain chemicals that are used in sand mining. We don't really have a clue what they're using and what the impact of the discharges are going to be. And as we know, you know, just last month you had the first frac sand mining company that was ordered to pay for water violations. This was a company that was near Blair. And I think this is becoming a very important issue. You know, why are we allowing these companies to violate the law and break the law, and then it takes ages to finally get them through litigation to the courts, and they're slapped on the wrist and given a penalty. Meanwhile, they continue to do the same violatory behavior that had led to this crisis in the first place. And I think Wisconsin really is going to become another ground zero for a real environmental, but more importantly, a huge health crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you say? I'm sure you hear this all the time in West Virginia and from national politicians as well, Bob. Well, it's the price that we have to pay. You know, we're going to have to take a few risks here, and there might be some injuries. There might be some spills. It's the price we pay for the modern society, for heating our homes. It's a price we don't have clean energy yet, so we need to take a few risks.
There's risk, and then there is recklessness, Kathleen. And the fact of the matter is, a risk is something that one takes having made a decision among a number of choices. There are no choices in West Virginia. The conversation that was had a few moments ago about green energy or renewable energy in West Virginia, I've got some experience with that because I've been trying to figure out a way to transfer to solar energy here in my radio studio. And the state of West Virginia makes it intentionally difficult to leverage that kind of technology. So to say that we're going to have to take some risks, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs, is disingenuous at best, because the political class and the corporate class are not the ones taking the risks. The risks are being taken by those 1,000 people a year that Jeff mentioned who still die of black lung. And in the case of mountaintop removal, the risks have even been transferred onto innocent people who are doing nothing more than trying to live out their lives on a daily basis next to these monstrous, humongous demolition complexes that coat them with toxic dust and foul their water.
Hmm. So I'm intrigued. What? Who's making it difficult for you to turn your radio studio solar?
The absolute hostility that is legislatively created in this state toward renewable energy. You know, there's no credits here. There are no incentives, and there's very little in the way of infrastructure.
Thanks very much, Marcia, for your call. Let's go to Ross in Washburn. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for this show, and hi to Bob Kincaid, who has been a great friend of ours in the North as we try to fight the GTAC, largest taconite mine in the world project up here. I would like to underscore that if anyone is listening in Wisconsin who thinks that this hasn't come home to roost here, they're living in a fool's paradise. Even if we manage to keep GTAC from destroying our watershed, the laws that have been written by corporations have changed how wetlands are destroyed. The high-capacity wells can be put in nearly anywhere and destroy the wells surrounding it, and so on and so on. It's a mess. And I guess I'm wondering, how did we end up with this extraordinarily right-wing government that in this state and across the United States as well, that allows this greedy, money-based agenda to thrive in a state that a few years ago was known as one of the greatest states in the country for environmental regulation?
Well, and it was not that long ago. There were I think it was Richard Nixon who got the Clean Water Act passed. It has been an issue that is of importance to people of all political persuasions in the past. So who is benefiting from this, and why did we switch to a time where we could even allow this, Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, whatever you are, allow this to happen?
Well, there's a short answer there, Kathleen, and hi, Roz. It's awful good to talk to you. It is precisely because Wisconsin had the good government that it had that it was targeted. Okay, the shorthand way that I express it is there's no fun for Alec or the Koch brothers in making Alabama weirder. It's a place like Wisconsin that has popular government in place that's trying very hard to do right by its citizenry. That's where it all has to be dismantled, and that's why you have seen, I think, the brutal vehemence with which institutions that you thought were going to be there to protect not just the present but the future as well. That's why they've been attacked the way they have.
Tell me about the work you're doing in northern Wisconsin, Bob.
Well, I'm not doing any. I'm just pleased and honored that I've been allowed to come up and share a little of our experience here in Appalachia with folks on the ground who are struggling against Gogebic taconite and the people behind it. Like I said, a West Virginian, and I feel shame in even saying that, but when I found out that was going on at the kind invitation of some wonderful people up there, I was invited to come up and talk a little bit about the science behind mountaintop removal, what people can expect in terms of disease and the poisoning of the water and the air. And I recognized in the instant that I arrived there that I felt a sense of kinship that I had never felt before. And I'm really, really inspired by the response that's going on up there, because you have a brilliant coalition of both, for lack of a better term, white folks and the tribal peoples who appear to me to be working together to stop this. There's amazing leadership coming out of the Bad River the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe people, as well as the Lac-Couturier people, and the allies that they have in communities like Ashland. It is I'm convinced when they tell me that they are that this mine is not going to happen up there, I'm convinced that A, they mean it, and B, they're right.
Interesting. How do you explain, because, Jeff, there were hundreds of thousands of people, and there still are people, I'm sure, in West Virginia who are darned afraid, and rightfully so, to be drinking water there. It's a story that's received national attention. Water issues, we've just heard, are surfacing in Wisconsin and in other states as well. Doesn't it become politically beneficial to be on the side of the health of the people who elected you? I mean, doesn't that, don't we see a change politically that people won't put up with shady stuff going on between politicians and people who are trying to get away from regulations?
Right. You would think so. And I think for, you know, most like-minded people, you would think so. But once again, we can't underestimate the power of these huge corporate lobbies that go to Washington, that go to state capital, that provide a tremendous amount of money, do massive amounts of contribution, hundreds of millions of dollars, to ultimately sway over the representatives, the governors, and the federal representatives all the way up to the Obama administration. I think that's what we're dealing with, are very, very the long legacy of these huge extraction lobbies and their impacts both on the state level and the federal level. But, you know, moments like this, you hope, will begin to shift public opinion. I think for anybody who's a parent, for example, like I am, I even have a filter on our faucet here, you know, for regular water. You know, if you begin to think of what position would you be in if you were a young mother, a young father, or a grandparent, and you're giving your kid a glass of water out of the faucet, and you're not even sure you can trust your public officials. You know, what does that really say about the democracy that you're living in? You know, whether or not you truly have a voice, or is that voice ultimately subverted by some corporate lobby that's able to make a massive donation? And I think moments like this, when we do see the personal stories, we do see the health crisis, we take it away from that kind of debate between jobs and the environment, those kind of false arguments, and we really bring it down to an issue of health and rights. Do we have a right to clean water? I'm incorrigibly optimistic. I do hope this will begin to shift the conversation and have an impact in society, at least for get people to be aware. But I think that kind of awareness has to go back to the origins of our consumption in the first place. I think, once again, your listeners have to ask themselves this question. Do they even know where their electricity comes from?
Right.
Are you using a coal fire plant or a natural gas plant? And do you know ultimately the huge health cost it takes in other states just to have the lights on in Wisconsin?
And we welcome you to our conversation. If you'd like to join us, there are lots of ways you can do so. We're talking with guests from West Virginia about the horrible industrial chemical crude MCHM leak into the Elk River in West Virginia, which affected 300,000 people, told that their tap water was unsafe for drinking, for showering, for household use, and people have gone to the hospital, and some people say that the water still smells bad, and it's got a funny color, and there, understandably, if you've been through something like that, you question what your officials are saying to you, and the whole process, the regulatory process that's supposed to be something you take for granted. Your water is clean. Your water is okay to drink. We have two guests with us. Jeff Biggers is an award-winning author. His stories have appeared on National Public Radio, Public Radio International, in the New York Times. He's the author of a number of books, including The United States of Appalachia, How Southern Mountaineers Brought Independence, Culture, and Enlightenment to America. Bob Kincaid, nationally known broadcaster, co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, and president of Coal River Mountain Watch. He lives in Fayette County, West Virginia. His ancestors settled there in the mid-18th century. More phone calls. We have one line open if you've been trying to reach us, 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Bruce in Warren, Illinois. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I wanted to say that in Wisconsin, we've been beholden to the industrial dairy facilities the same way that other states are beholden to coal or, in Iowa, the hog industries. And in a number of counties in Wisconsin, particularly in the Dalles areas and near Green Bay, one-third of all wells are already so contaminated that people can't drink them. It's mainly from nitrate, so it's not necessarily as deadly as the chemicals that were released by the coal industry, but it's nonetheless renders the wells unusable by people or their livestock. And the same issue here is that industry controls the government. And it's the same thing. You can just take the name of the state and change it and the name of the industry and change it, and the same problems go on all across the United States. And I think that until people wake up to that, as they're starting to, we're going to be run by corporations that have controlled the industries, not the industry, but control the regulators.
Jeff.
No, I think that's a very good point, and I think you could even say the same, of course, for corn in Iowa. And a lot of the recent evidence that's come out of the corn rush that Iowa's going through and the impact it's having both with nitrogen and phosphorus being dumped into the rivers that ultimately are ending up in the dead zone of the Gulf. So I think it's a huge issue. I think ultimately we talk about it in issues of democracy. Are we going to be able to have rights of communities to determine that they can protect their clean water source, especially for people who live off a well, live in the rural areas, or are we going to have those rights subverted in our democracy by corporate lobbyists who are able to get more representation in our state capitals and in the national capital, federal capitals of Washington? I think something your listeners might want to look into, and even a potential program, is in Wisconsin and in Iowa and other communities now, there's a very lively community rights movement that is saying that local communities should have the right to be able to decide, for example, whether or not they're going to be doing fracking within the city limits, and that they will ultimately have control over some of the oversight. And I think that kind of community rights movement might be one step, and we don't really know yet, of a movement toward bringing democracy back to people and basic rights like clean water.
You know, send us some info on it. We'll be happy to do a show. I wanted to find out a little bit more and get a larger perspective on this too, Bob, about this Freedom Industries. They've gone bankrupt in the last couple of days, the company that owned the facility where the leak occurred. Is this just a really bad actor or renegade company, or can you identify others that are problematic?
These are par for the course around here, Kathleen. We've got, as Jeff mentioned earlier, Massey Energy was cited numerous times, time after time after time, for horrible, horrible violations in their operations. It's par for the course around here. And in point of fact, the bankruptcy isn't even that shocking. I remarked the other day that I expect them to reincorporate as Liberty Industries, maybe, because it's that kind of an Orwellian atmosphere around here. And one other thing, just to toss out there, is that West Virginia American Water, much to their pleasure, is getting a big pass in all of this. But there are still a lot of questions that remain, one of which is how do you be a provider of potable water to nearly 500,000 people and not notice that there's a tank farm? I mean, this wasn't just one tank.
Right, yeah.
But there's a tank farm a mile and a half upstream from you.
Well, that's a good question. How can you not notice that?
And around... I don't know. The fact of the matter is, though, West Virginia American Water is a subsidiary of American Water, and they are a publicly traded corporation as of, I think, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, their goal, their focus is going to be on shareholder profits. above and beyond and entirely.
Jeff, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, I think it really points that state enforcement of these laws is just simply not happening. But I think also on the federal level, it's very important to point out that in an AP investigation last week, they found out that three-quarters of the 1,700 coal mines in the United States have not even been inspected in the last 5 years to see if they're following water pollution laws. And they're using the same chemicals in terms of their coal slurry, which actually could potentially go into our watersheds and waterways as well. So we're not only talking about a massive case of rogue state agencies, but we're talking about a very serious case of lack of federal enforcement as well, and simply just investigation. And so this is really a crisis for the country. It's a crisis. It's a health crisis. It's an environmental crisis. It's an economic crisis, because ultimately this has a major impact on economies when we have these disasters. And it's ultimately a humanitarian crisis, because people are really paying the ultimate price for this kind of inaction.
Richard in Hayward. Hi.
Hello?
Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
I want to talk about Warren Buffett and his BNSF railroad that wants to haul the dirtiest coal in our country out in Wyoming or Montana. He wants to ship it out there to the West Coast and sell it to China, and we can't. And this is coal that will not be allowed to be burned in the USA. I'd like to hear your comments, please.
All right, Richard. Thanks.
I did a piece a couple of years ago when I called it All the President's Coal Men, talking about just months up to the opening of even more of the Powder River Basin in Wyoming and Montana for an incredible amount of leasing of federal lands for coal mining, that Warren Buffett had made tremendous news by saying that he was going to bet on coal. And, of course, Warren Buffett is not only training away all the coal that ultimately will be put on terminals and shipped off to Asia, but as we speak, the coal trains that are going through Wisconsin from Wyoming to Chicago and across the nation are on Warren Buffett's own train lines. And, of course, once again, you know, last Sunday, you guys had 19 coal trains derail in Caledonia, Wisconsin, that were on that same line.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this issue of Warren Buffett is huge, that we have great financiers. Buffett has made great inroads in terms of funding wind energy, for example, in Iowa. But at the same time, he has a tremendous amount of money invested in keeping the coal industry alive.
Mm. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us. Do you feel that the press is abandoning you now, or are they still on the story? National press.
There is still some coverage, but it needs to be understood as a much more national crisis than it is.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Our guest, Jeff Biggers. Jeff has written extensively about all that's been going on in West Virginia before this chemical leak. He's an award-winning author. We thank Bob Kincaid for being with us as well, broadcaster, co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and president of Coal River Mountain Watch. Several of you have written in about the Pinoki Hills mine, and our station in Superior has done a terrific job of covering this, and we haven't talked about it very much on this show, so I think that the conversation that we have just had will get us going on scheduling something on that issue pretty soon. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production. And stay with us for a show about greed coming up.